marvellous. A weather today, highs of 10 degrees centigrade, lows of 8 degrees centigrade. A cloudy day, but generally feeling mild. Michael, you're about to leave us. A final plug, of course, for Tuesday's event. And I use capital E-V-E-N-T with respect to that. Hashtag, you know, the event. Poetry reading. Something happens sometimes here.
Yes, indeed. Tuesday night, 7 o'clock in the library. There's going to be about five or six of us, Lincolnshire poets.
Or is it a case that the word is refreshing enough?
The word is definitely refreshing itself. But as they say, as they used to say, be there or be square. Because it's free as well. You're not likely to get a bunch of poets of this calibre, you know, in one place for free, so get yourself along there.
How true those words are. And Claire, has that persuaded you to probably make
it
that?
It has, yes, I think so. Shakespeare will have to wait for another day.
Well, I mean, he was more blank verse as opposed to kind of authentic poetry, so I mean, iambic pentameter.
Controversial.
Yeah, iambic pentameter is a line from that. You know, you want to sort of open up a whole range of things. And Mary, will you be sort of making your way to the poetry event?
I think so. I'll definitely be tending, actually.
That's what we like to hear.
Hi, I'm Rachel from On Broadcast. And you're listening to Alex Levchuk on the Midweek Drive.
Time and time again, I've tried to get back to my hometown. On my mind again, I'm on my way back. Take a look around at the places I remember. Will my picture come undone? I know why they say you just can't go home again. Yes, I know why they say you just can't go home again.
So very quickly before we actually find out more about this internships and more at MTech next Wednesday on 12th of 2nd of December, I should say, not 12th, 12th of February, I was reading the American side of things there. Things to Come, H.G. Wells' Things to Come, is being screened, part of a series of classic science fiction films presented in full and for free. Added podcast commentaries available. And you've got Raymond Massey, you've got Edward Chapman, you've got Ralph Richardson, the story of a century-long Second World War that leaves plague and anarchy before a rational state, rebuild civilization, and attempts space travel. So
I'm excited.
Yeah, I would hope so too. Yeah. It's like that or a bomb that actually has to be taught for phenomenology. Big ones get away. Possibly you need to address that when you talk about careers. We've spoken about this regularly through the first hour of the programme. 4 out of 5 students expecting to work without pay once they leave university. We've got, of course, 2 fine undergraduates with us in the studio who will be graduating shortly and will be heading into this routine. And to address this and the fascinating results of a survey which was conducted by the company 10 Minutes With, we're delighted to be able to welcome the CEO of the aforementioned career matching service and company 10 Minutes With. That would be the legendary Matt Cockett. Matt, good morning. How are you?
Good morning, guys.
Excellent. So, Matt, share with us this particular survey, which is quite interesting, which suggests that, you know, we need to be positive about these kind of things, but the expectation, 2/3 of students expect to secure an interview in under 10 applications, but 1 in 10 also wants to be self-employed or join a startup. Only 20% of STEM students at science, technology, engineering and mathematics expect to pursue a career in that particular field. And, of course, the headliner, 4 out of 5 students expect to work without pay once they leave university. Were you surprised at all?
Yeah, I think we were a little bit surprised that such a high proportion were expecting to work without pay. But that's definitely indicative of a trend towards internships, which can be very positive, I think, a very good experience for students.
Absolutely. Let's bring in our undergraduates here. I mean, Claire, you're thinking about going into a career in publishing?
Yes, yeah. I really would like to work in book publishing. And the one thing everyone has always said to me is work experience or internships. Mm. And I've been more inclined to use my university time to get those internships and stuff. But you tend to have money to be able to go down to London or wherever to do these internships because you don't get paid. And everyone always says it's not just about your degree anymore. It's like about what you do extra. And I think there is that pressure to get the work experience and work for free when you finish, mm-hmm. unfortunately.
Is that something which resonates with yourself in terms of what you hear? I mean, Matt, from the sort of line, this particular aspect. Hello, Matt?
Yes, I'm here. Yeah, I mean, I wasn't sure if it was directed to me.
Yes.
Yeah, so definitely, I mean, we find a lot of interest in people even coming to come work for us as a startup business, you know, as an intern. I think the key thing for anyone thinking about an internship is they have to consider it as being a very quick path to something that leads to the job or to something being paid, particularly within that company itself. And I think it sometimes could be beholden on the actual graduate themselves to sort of make that clear to the employer that they're not there forever, that it's for something that, yes, they want to gain experience, but they also bring a lot of skills. Young people bring skills to businesses that are very necessary, things like experience with social media or specific skills from their degree course. So I think it's also about being managed on both sides, so both parties are getting a lot out of the experience and it doesn't go on forever.
And Mary, from your own perspective, again, also rather like Claire, you're in the final year of your English undergraduate programme at the University of Lincoln. Your thoughts about where you're heading career-wise?
I think I want to do something towards PR and maybe more social media aspects because, yeah, I do think that's more of a trend that's going to have more jobs in that sector potentially. I did an internship as well before uni for Starcom MediaVest, so a research agency for brands like Samsung and Pizza Hut and various other ones. And, yeah, there is this almost a need, I guess, for young people to have all of this experience. So you're like, well, how do I get it?
10 Minutes With has been a phenomenal success story. I mean, it was founded originally in 2013, headquartered in central London. You've got representatives in Beijing, Singapore, India, also expanded obviously into Europe, Africa, Southeast Asia, and so on. I mean, from your own perspective, Matt, is this something else that, as we sort of see the development of courses across the globe, that people often need to think outside the country and actually think globally and internationally in terms of work placements and areas?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's certainly a trend towards that. We see it amongst our customer base, people applying for jobs with a little bit more flexibility on the location of that role. I mean, I think the key thing that we see is that there is no shortage of really smart graduates coming out of top universities around the world. I think what's really important now that businesses like ours really help those candidates find the jobs, because the jobs are, you know, even though there's a lot of technology out there in the market, they can still be a little bit like finding a needle in a haystack. We also get a lot of feedback from our customers that they don't get much feedback when they apply for jobs. So that's something we're also trying to fix, about when candidates apply for jobs and they may not necessarily hear anything back. Why didn't they hear anything back? Is it because of something on their CV or something that they should be more experienced in? Yeah. So there's also a shift towards technology helping matching people to roles, wherever they may be in the world and whatever they may have studied.
We're constantly maintaining a positive outlook. It is important that you're positive, but at the same time, sometimes we find it difficult to deal with rejection. Being human, it's a natural sort of scenario. Looking at the sort of survey that you produced within 10 Minutes With, almost two-thirds of students would expect to secure a job interview in fewer than 10 applications. Is that a reasonable expectation, or is that a case of, no, you've got to go for 100 at least?
Yeah, I think that's probably a little bit on the positive side, really. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think, as the guys in your studio may say, you know, you have to continue to put out many applications. And a lot of the guys we speak to as well, they're not just putting out applications. They're networking. They're trying to find connections in companies and also trying to get experience. And, as much experience you can get before graduation is the best. But also, if you can find that way of an internship, internship, and we've seen internships happen for 1 month and that for that to immediately turn into a full-time job. So it doesn't necessarily have to go on for such a long time, but it effectively bankrupts people when they're already coming out of university with a fair amount of debt on average anyway.
Claire, questions from yourself?
Yes, I guess that what I would ask is how valuable do you think getting work experience primarily in the sector you're wanting to work in? Because obviously working in publishing, there are a lot of aspects from different jobs that I could do as work experience that would benefit that.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think what we always look for, certainly when I've managed graduate roles in the past as well, is I always look for the candidate to have an idea of what function in a business they think they roughly would like to fit into. So, you know, sales, marketing, creative, accounting. You know, I think it's really encouraging to see someone that has a feel for where, not necessarily definitely, but where they longer term would like to fit within a business. And then that they've shown some initiative to create some, you know, collateral of their own. So if you're into, you know, for example, we employed an intern of our own recently. She wants to work in PR long term. So she's been doing quite a lot of her own writing and blogging. And I know it's a bit of a burden on people to think that we have to be a great author and to do a lot of your own blogging. But she does actually create quite a lot of her own copy. And from our side, that means we can then use that skill to help us on our social media side of our business. So I definitely think if you're interested in a topic and into a particular function, then just start doing it anyway. Start getting interested in it and creating your own portfolio. And that will go a long way when you get to talking to potential employers.
And Mary, thoughts from yourself?
No, all of that sounds great, actually.
So it's positive thinking all the way around in our sort of 10-minute section with 10 minutes over of a CEO, which is brilliant. How can people actually find out more in terms of actually accessing the company? As we said, it's going from strength to strength ever since the founder, Manfredi De Cintio. Have I got the pronunciation right there?
Yes, he's an Italian.
That sort of aspect in there. Since it was actually founded, the web address presumably will be 10 minutes with. Is that correct, Matt?
That's right, yeah. You can Google search 10 minutes with, and then we've recently, in the last week, launched a mobile app. So you can download our app from the Apple Store or the Android Store, just search 10 minutes with, and that will match you up to start matching you up with articles, videos about learning about careers and jobs.
Sounds really helpful.
Yeah, definitely.
It sounds like very accessible for graduates who obviously have quite a lot on their plate but are wanting to kind of find out more without having to go see someone or pay someone to find out more.
As well, in these big, like, I think concepts like PR or marketing, like what functions and breaking down where you fit into all of that will be very, very useful.
It's a thumbs up all round, Matt.
It is.
Two final questions for your good self.
Brilliant.
Have you had a reasonably interesting telephonic link with us on the programme this morning? Has it been okay for you?
I've really enjoyed it. Thanks so much. And good luck in your search, guys.
Thank you.
And maybe we can prevail upon you to join us again in the not too distant future, maybe in 2016, to keep us appraised of how things are going with 10 Minutes With. Will you return?
Sounds good. Sounds good, of course.
Now on the Midweek Drive Morning Edition for culinary class and gastronomic gorgeousness with the broadcasting legend who is William Sitwell.
Who already has actually created huge amusement with both Claire Margerison and indeed newbie Mary Dancy on the production because of the update on his Facebook page. One is tempted to be flattered, but then you saw what the name was. Yes, we can't say the name, but yeah. You'll appreciate, William, that with two English undergraduates in the studio, they did appreciate the vernacular there. It's very good. Good morning,
well,
William.
You know, good morning. Yes. Yeah, well, you know, there are trolls and there's quality trolling.
That's
a quality troll. We love it. more of that, please.
Exactly. So what's life like now? We're approaching that festive season in earnest. We had a few teasers last week and sorting through aspects within that whole side of things. Waitrose effectively all on course for another tremendously successful festive period.
Whatever, if that's what you say, then I'm sure that's what it will be. I mean, from where I'm sitting this morning, view of the blue sky and underneath the M40 or whatever it is, the A40 flyover, life's looking all right, you know. You know, George Osborne's looking happy, you know. So, you know,
Well, that's all we can ask
for. What
can
I say?
Exactly. That's all we can ask for.
What can I say? What can I say? Just keep it simple, you know, when it comes to Christmas. One white, one red, one sparkling, one port.
Sorted.
One turkey, one cheese, one sausage.
Now, Mary Dancy, who is new to the Midweek Drive Morning Edition, is an English undergraduate, level three, dropped in an email saying she'd quite like to be on the show. I said, well, drop by this week. We found out, William, that she actually originates from that small place that you're working in at present. Yes, London, as opposed to the village of Lincoln, has kind of done the reverse of the whole thing. So whereabouts in London, Mary, are you actually based?
I'm from East London, so I live in Leighton, which is right next to Stratford Westfield.
Oh, so,
okay. Is that actually London, is it?
Yes.
That's technically. London, is it?
Technically, yes.
Well,
that's where that's near Bow. That's where we film MasterChef up there.
Oh, wow. So I'm actually right on your doorstep.
But don't worry, William, she's not a stalker, honestly. Anyway, Mary, questions for William about life, the universe, or indeed how to cope with your final months as an undergraduate reading English.
I suppose, what does the universe have to offer me? I'm not too sure.
If you just asked me that, what does the universe have to? I think you should think, what do you have to offer the universe?
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
That's what you need to think about. Don't sit there waiting for the universe to offer you stuff. You've got to get out there and start offering. You've got to start giving. You've got to start, you know.
We have indeed just come out of a feature with 10 Minutes with Chief Executive Officer Matt Cockett. I was so tempted to go Miami Vice, but I thought, no, it's his first piece on the programme. We have to sort of just hold it back. I can't talk about Crockett and Tubbs at this particular stage. But it was some interesting news about a recent survey which actually pointed out 4 out of 5 students expect to work without pay once they leave university. Two-thirds of students expect to secure an interview in under 10 applications. One in 10 actually wants to be self-employed or join a startup. And we're just wondering, William, from your own perspective, as editorial director at John Brown Media and so on, do you get flooded with applications from students saying, please, 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 can I be your intern?
Oh, all the time. And I go and do talks at places like City University, where I speak to all these students, and then they besiege us, because, you know, particularly in the media, it's hard because you do have to do a bit of work experience, work for free, and then hope you're in the right place at the right time and you get lucky. So you need to rely on the fact you hope you've got friends or family who can put you up, you know, for those early years while you're, you know, people who get into, let's say, the fashion world or Vogue, you know, they probably spend, you know, a year in the Vogue fashion cupboard working for free before, you know, maybe an opportunity would arise. It's very competitive, and even when you then get into journalism, I mean, given the fact that so much writing is now demanded of students for nothing, people writing for websites for nothing, it's very, very hard. Yeah, so, you know, I suppose if you've got that expectation, at least, you know, you're entering with your eyes open. 1 in 10 applications get a job interview. That's not too bad, actually, I don't think.
Mm-hmm. The average would apparently be 39 applicants for every graduate job.
It's hard. You have to just be entrepreneurial.
Yeah.
And you've got to come in with a CV that shows that you've been active in that particular field. You know, so if you say you want to get into food writing, then you need to display an interest, show that you've been blogging and show that you've been doing it.
It's important to obviously develop that publishing side of things as well, because Claire is actually looking to go into publishing, and it's a side we hadn't mentioned before, obviously, with your own role at John Brown Media. Shameless plug once again. But yes, publishing is still something that connects. What is it about publishing, Claire, in particular that appeals?
Well, I've always loved books, and I love reading, and I always have done, and I think that I would really like to work with authors, work with people who like books, work with just in that whole sphere of working with books, because obviously people tend to think if you like books, oh, you're going to be a writer. And I do enjoy writing, but I think I'd rather be on the other side of it. And I'm really interested in editorial. It's something I've always sort of enjoyed doing, and I do a bit of blogging, and I write for an online magazine as well, which is a group of young people writing about current issues and that sort of thing. So it's good fun. It's just trying to balance everything, really.
I would say you're already one step ahead of a lot of other people, since you have an idea of what you want to do.
Hopefully.
I'm still trying to figure it out.
Yeah.
But you could also think about the agency side of things.
Definitely.
Agents' representation of authors.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, I was with my agent yesterday talking about my latest book, and people in that agency are our editors as well, and working with authors. So you can be in the publishing side, you can be in the marketing side, you can be in the agency side. There's lots of opportunities really for someone who's
keeping my mind
bright and
open
on it.
From your own experience, William, as a graduate of the University of Kent, Canterbury, one of their finest, in fact, just share with us your own career pathway, because it was quite interesting in terms of how you sort of headed into this. And now, of course, multimedia broadcaster extraordinaire, you know, regular Soho radio star, and so on.
It was a pretty random sort of desperate grabbing at things. So I left university with a degree in politics and government, and I went and worked on a Greek island, naturally. And then I got work for an MP as a sort of PA press person. And through that, I met the political editor of the Sunday Express, who I was chatting to. He said, you know, what do you want to do? And I said, I'd love to work on a newspaper. He got me an interview on one of their supplements, a magazine called Classic, and I got a job as a researcher. And then before I knew it, I was writing features. And so then I was at the Sunday Express for a year and a half, 2 years, and then was made redundant, bizarrely, at quite a young age, because they sort of closed, they merged the two titles, the Sunday and the Daily Express. And then I tried to freelance miserably for about a year, and then I got rescued by a friend of a friend who was an editor of a magazine called Women's Journal, an amazing woman called Marcel Darji Smith. She put me on her features desk, and I sort of squatted there for about
a
year.
That was what Marcel liked to do, isn't it, really? Have young men sort of squat on their desks.
Yeah, I was there to sort of tell jokes. I mean, I didn't know what I was doing there. And then it was a friend of the magazine I currently work on who knew the editor, and she was looking for a deputy, and so I got an interview as deputy, and got that job as deputy in about May 99, and I've sort of stayed on this magazine and then made food my life from, you know, books, TV, radio, magazines.
And then, of course, there was the fateful day when we did the first William Sitwell ISBN interview, and we've never really looked back. It's been just a partnership.
Absolutely. So it's a sort of, you know, you grab what you can, and wherever you are, you try and do the best of it, and you hope you're lucky, and you schmooze, and you network, and you don't rely on anything but your own.
I think that's really encouraging.
Luck, you know. There seems to be a logic to my career, but honestly, it was completely random.
Yeah, I think it's really encouraging to hear, because obviously you end up doing odds and ends, and also I've just got an offer from Kent for my master's, so that's really exciting.
Well, you see those connections there, you know. She could be doing the postgraduate master's course at your alma mater, William.
Yeah, hopefully.
Yeah, you can see the plaque on the wall.
Yes, exactly.
Drunk idiot was here.
But I just think it is about sort of picking up what you can get. It's networking, meeting people, and it's really encouraging.
And if you can, you know, and if you're lucky enough to end up doing something you enjoy, then you're very, very lucky.
Yeah.
This has been William Sitwell Career Advice on 107.3 FM. No mention of food whatsoever. Sometimes we don't need to. It's just a case of the spiritual experience. As you said, Mary, what will the universe actually have in store for us? We weren't expecting that. There we are. William, last two questions are going to be beamed at you from Claire Margerrison.
Have you enjoyed your telephonic link with us today, William?
Yeah, better than last week, which was a weird one, let's face it.
It always gets a bit weird. And will you be joining us again next week?
It's up to the big man.
The dictator.
Please, you know, friend the autocratic neighbourhood despot.
Of course,
at worst,
of course.
Really, you know, it's a different line. William will return. Shortly after he was living La Vida Loca and working with Meja on Mia, Private Emotion. Siren 107.3 FM, 22 minutes to 10 o'clock, and we say it's Alan Stevens and Fiona Moore time. Good morning, folks. How are you?
Pretty good. How are you?
Excellent. Delighted. And, of course, introductions. Two fine folk in London, specifically in Staines, which you could say is not really London at all, but it's a suburb of London, or greater London, maybe. We have two undergraduates, one of whom is from London as well, but the eastern part of London, as you just heard. That would be Mary Dancy, and also Secretary of the University of Lincoln Science Fiction, or Treasurer of Science Fiction Film Society.
Right.
Treasurer of the Science Fiction Society, which is great. You know, you would have thought we would have connected beforehand, but thanks to Claire Margerrison.
People together.
Clearly, exactly, like a good publisher.
Yes.
There we are, great stuff. And lo and behold, Starburst magazine, that incendiary editorial that Alan sent me a text about.
Yeah, don't be care about what you say there.
They have actually sort of done an apology in the latest Star Wars edition, which we'll come to. But it was extraordinary. I must admit, I shared your thoughts, Alan, that it seemed an unusual line to take. And I won't ask you which side of the fence you came down on. Was it the role of the editor? Was it actually the letter writer who dared to use the word vile, which I think was probably over the top?
Yeah.
Well, okay. Mm. Paul Mount used to be involved with Starburst, certainly throughout the 1980s. I remember he had a column there. Originally, Starburst, I think, was produced by another title, wasn't it? Who was it, Fiona? Do you remember?
Marvel Comics and Deskin.
Marvel, was it?
Yes, they used to.
Yeah.
Used to. Deskin used to. And Alan McKenzie, in fact, I think.
Yeah, that's right. Alan McKenzie did it. And
one of my early interviewees, Alan McKenzie, was.
Was he really?
Yeah. Anyway.
But anyway, it collapsed. And the title was taken up by, I think it was Stephen Payne and Jan Vincent Rudzki.
Exactly.
At that point, Paul Mount used to do this column called "It's Only a Movie." I don't know if it's still called "It's Only a Movie," but he used to do this, and he sort of styled himself as this kind of acerbic, grumpy person. So I was quite surprised when I read it and said he loved Doctor Who since the '60s, because I remember him attacking Kazar and Lazani and saying it all took place in the Portaloo, and also I remember he.
And it was only last night, Claire, we were talking with the director of Caves of Androzani, yeah, Graham Harper, and we wouldn't dare have said, Graham, did it not look as though it all took place in the Portaloo?
Yeah, it was a bit rude, I thought. And also, remember, he called an actress, who was, I won't name her, but she was in a series called Star Pop, said she had a face like a bag of spanners.
Oh, lovely. Ouch.
Yeah. So he was at the very least controversial, and you might even call him
offensive.
In today's parlance, you might even call him a hater.
Yeah.
But then, when RTD came along, he absolutely loved RTD and was really quite abusive to any fan who dared to suggest that RTD was not the greatest producer of the show or showrunner of a show ever. And you can do these sort of animated cartoon things, you know, talking. There's one on YouTube actually of him as a clown talking to someone about how RTD was the best thing ever, and how if you didn't like him, then you were clearly retarded in some way. But then, completely opposite happened, because when Moffat took over, he absolutely hated Moffat and everything that he accused everyone else of. He then became a kind of
So there's not a great deal of consistency here, is what you're saying?
Well, there is, isn't there? I mean, it diverts from extreme hate to extreme love, and back to extreme hate again. So that's what he's consistent about. He's consistent in his hatred or his love. When he loves something, there is you cannot criticize it in any way. But if he hates something, then virtually everything about it is terrible. So, I mean, I've never met him as a person. So, I'm sure as a person, he's far more well-rounded and, so if you
met him.
I don't know. But, I mean, what I'm trying to say is that I don't want to completely say that this is him, because we all have different aspects to ourselves in who we meet and what form we're working in. And I suppose if they say we want a columnist who's controversial, then he's going to play to that. But anyway, so the fact that it all blew up over Paul Mount didn't surprise me. The letter written in was a bit pompous, wasn't it? Sir, I do blah 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 blah. I have met Stephen Moffat and Sir, and all this stuff. But I thought the reply was went on for about five columns, didn't it? I mean,
However, if you want to find out more, buy the magazine or the back.
Yeah, I know. Certainly. I mean, I picked it up in David Smith and thought I'd just read the first line to see what was going on.
You can't just get away with that, Alan.
I just read the entire thing.
Exactly. By the way, that's one of my pet hates when you're actually in a newsagent's. Obviously, they're all around. You see people just reading. You say, it's not a library. It's not like you want to get.
But you can't get Starburst at the library, can you?
And that's a great shame. I'll obviously set to work on that. Just showing our two colleagues in the studio there a wonderful shot of the dynamic duo that are Professor Fiona Moore and Alan Stevens signing, it would seem, or about to sign, under the heading When Liberation Met Blake's Heaven.
Very nice.
Going to the launch for the Blake's Heaven collection, which goes as articles in. And, it was a James who took that photo, Alan, do you remember?
Yeah, I do, yeah. We were actually signing a copy of Liberation because there was a guy who bought his book along and said, could you sign it for us? So we said, okay. And then James said, I want to take a photograph of you. And I said, oh, God.
Quite rare to have an Alan Stevens photograph. He normally sort of hides away, which is why, once again, when we reveal next year's, or at least upcoming 2016 calendar, Fiona, once again, is in the calendar of next year. Alan, not so much.
Well, I just don't like, oh, I feel very self-conscious when I'm having my photograph taken. You know, I don't know why.
Last night, of course, we had a person who was very fulsome in his praise for you, Alan. It was a bit of history. Claire was present for that history-making epoch.
Yeah.
The first time he'd ever actually shared a full two-hour show with us. We'd met him, we'd worked with him in events up and down the country. It was, of course, Claire, the amazing...
Derek Hamley.
Yes.
Oh, Derek, he's all right, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Now living in Lincolnshire, which is always where the best people are, you know.
Yes. So. It's the place to be.
And, sneak preview here, conceivably... a co-producer of Telefancy and Society 2, currently being beamed somewhere on a Saturday in November 2016. There we are. Okay, moving on from that point of view, because clearly, Mary, you are here not only because of your amazing English strategies and such like, and your treasury holding skills for the Science Fiction Society at the University of Lincoln, but also because, as Claire said, it's all right with Mary. She knows her Doctor Who. She's sorted. She'll be able to bounce off stuff with respect to all sorts of things, etc. So, you know, with Alan being a Doctor Who scholar, likewise Fiona as well, you know, you're ideally positioned to actually consider the whole sort of series. How has the Peter Capaldi era been panning and unwrapping for yourself? Panning
well,
out?
I quite like it, but my flatmate actually instead is an insane fan and she loves all of it. So really my knowledge is kind of filtered a little bit more.
So it's osmosis, really.
Yes, yeah.
By an insane fan, because clearly Alan, as editor of Celestial Toymaker, might have encountered a couple in various ways. Are we talking certifiable here? Are we talking...
Not certifiable. No? She's got all the merchandise, and I'm actually quite impressed with her. So
right.
She's...
Can I give her a name check?
Yeah.
No. Yes. No.
Hope. That's right.
Hope. Oh, fine. So, clearly, we can't hold fire any longer after the sensational sleep episode, which I know you felt. Where is it going with respect to it? Has it improved? Has it got? Has the mojo returned, or is it a case of no? Now we know Clara's on her way. It may never be the same again.
Have you got my Facebook page up there?
Yes, we do. Actually, we do.
Can you pull it up?
It is actually up as we speak. Right. We've got that there. Yeah.
Do you see the picture at all of it?
The picture of the person who's actually holding the camera.
No, what are you trying to look for, Fiona?
His avatar is currently a raven with a gun.
Yes, that's exactly. Yeah. We have got a raven with a gun. Yes,
we have.
Yeah. We have got that. We are do this at home if it's safe and legal to do so. If you're in a car, please avoid it. So where do we go from now?
Well. Face the Raven, so that's actually a gun from Blake 7.
Nice.
Blake can even face the Raven.
He's using distracting techniques here to get away from talking about Doctor Who.
Okay, well, I didn't really like it very much. Again, we go back to the... I'm turning into Paul Mount. The difference is I like
is
the
he,
first
Is he, Fiona?
Episodes.
Is Alan actually metamorphosing at this moment into Paul Mount?
I wouldn't know. I've never met Paul.
Oh, well, there we are. So he could be. Okay, carry on, Alan. So this is not looking good with only a couple more episodes of the things to go before we go into the grand, spectacular Christmas special.
Again, like the first four episodes, but everything since then I have not liked. Didn't really like this episode very much. I thought the very, very slow Raven. You know, it was such a long, drawn-out death, which we know isn't a death anyway. Because no one died in Doctor Who anymore.
Yeah.
It just took so long to fly. I thought, come on, what were you doing? I was like, went off to get a pizza or something like that, or even snowboarding.
Looking good for Claire Margerrison's proposed Doctor Who Marathon, where she effectively sort of has a whole routine. I mean, this could be, at least with Dark Star, it was only 80 minutes.
Yeah, I've got to catch up on the last couple of episodes, actually. But I've seen recently a couple of people have been posting on Facebook about River Song returning for the Christmas special.
Yeah, right.
I'm not feeling that, because I feel like that story is done with now.
I think that story was done with like 5 years
ago.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's funny because when River Song first appeared, I kind of thought, oh. And then she kept appearing for the Matt Smith era. And I thought to myself, oh, she's getting better. You know, I'm not so bad. It's not so bad now. And then recently, there's a friend of mine called Stephen Allen. And every time I go to the Forest of Dean, we watch the new Who series back because he's got it all on DVD.
And I've been watching a lot of River Song recently, and no, I really actually dislike her quite enormously. So when I heard she was, I think it's the sort of the pretentiousness of it.
Yeah.
Not pretentious, but you know, yes, you will soar to the stars, and then you shall fall greatly. And think, oh, shut up, woman.
Yeah.
You know.
So when the
name of the doctor, she appeared to be, that was kind of implied it was her last appearance.
Yeah, it did.
And she's coming back.
She's returned.
Oh, to ruin my Christmas.
Oh, no.
Yeah. Yeah. The big problem, you know, even if, you know, against all expectations, Clara does actually remain dead, you know, the...
Well, Doctor Who magazine put a big picture on the front, doesn't it, from the last episode, so she... That was completely spoiled. Any idea that she was dead is completely spoiled. Thank you, Spilsbury.
Yeah, so that obviously, you know, hedging the bet that that's a flashback or a hologram or something. You know, the thing is that even if she, against all expectations, is indeed totally and thoroughly dead as Jacob Marley, you know, the fact is that any sentiment one could get from her death is kind of debased by the fact that they keep continually killing off characters and bringing them back, and she herself spent her entire first season being killed off and brought back in various ways, and you know, it's just got to the point where you're sort of like, you know, oh, they're playing the death card again, you know.
The thing is, if you know, a show is that they have you have a currency, and if you debase that currency by saying things like, you know, oh, look, you're trapped behind this impenetrable wall. We'll never see you again. Oh, look, there's a chink there. I've managed to come through now. Or, yes, he's dead forever. You'll never see him again. Oh, look, he's alive again. After a while, you think, well, you know, this isn't actually, you know, I'm not going to shed any tears over her because I don't really see, I think it's kind of a false, you know.
Yeah, because it's not final, is it? It's not.
No.
It's not like James T. Kirk in Generations where he goes, it's not like Tashi Yar in Star Trek The Next Generation. It's not even like Jadzia Dax who wants to, that's it. You know,
That was an interesting one, wasn't it? Because the actress, Denise Crosby, as far as I know, you probably know more about this than I do, but she decided that she didn't want to be in Star Trek. And I think, to be honest, in the first season, she was sort of, her character was kind of a bit fetishized, I remember. And anyway, they then kill her off. And then the show, of course, is a huge success. And they bring her back for Yes, It Is Enterprise, which I remember was a very, very good one, where it sort of takes place in an alternative universe where the Federation's at war and is losing. Was it against the Klingons?
Yeah,
or
it was. War with the Klingons and losing, obviously.
And of course,
no Worf.
In this opposite universe, that she was still alive. So that was a very poignant episode and very well done. And then they thought they'd bring her back as a Romulan.
Well, it was her daughter. Technically, it was her daughter. But,
And that carried on for, well, it was the same actress. That carried on for a while, and then they basically dumped the entire idea because they just thought they were pandering to her.
Exactly.
Yeah. So. Which they were. I mean, you know, I mean, the thing is that I think Yes, It Is Enterprise was excellent, as far as I remember it being, and it was great to bring her back. But I think, you know, to be honest, Denise Crosby wanted to leave the show, and although she did it, I mean, she used to write in to producers, and she said, I've got a brilliant idea how I can come back. Well, sorry, but you had your go. And I also don't think Denise Crosby was, you know.
Although, it's fair to say that Fraser Hans has been doing exactly the same thing with Stephen Moffat, so he has put forward various ideas as to how Jamie could actually return. But anyway, that's by the by.
Fraser Hines?
Indeed, yes.
Yeah. I mean, I think back in. I was talking to a friend of mine recently, he did an article for CT, plug, and he thinks that there was going to be a, you know, this season, you know, Doctor Who obviously found a problem during season 22. But he seems to think there was a setup, or going to be a setup, where Fraser and Trenton were going to reappear on a regular basis during the
There's that, and you know, we would be most remiss if we didn't ask, given your tremendous, phenomenal success in terms of audio productions, any thoughts on the recent release news that Big Finish Productions are actually going to be remaking The Prisoner?
It's a difficult one, isn't it? I mean, The Prisoner was remade.
Yes. It's not that version that's being remade. They're going back to source material here, apparently.
I thought the original, the remake, it was all right, but apparently everyone else hated it.
And, it had Ian McKellen in it as number one.
Yeah, I know, but it's completely fallen off the radar. It's like no one even acknowledges it exists anymore. I think the big problem we've got with remaking The Prisoner is that, A, you don't need a remake. it's already there in colour on film.
It's like doing H.G. Wells' Things to Come, which you can see free 2 o'clock at the MTech Theatre next Wednesday.
Oh, stop it.
The thing is, though, it's...
You haven't got Magoon in it. Magoon was the prisoner, really, wasn't he? He wrote a lot of the script, he directed a lot of it, he was the main man in it, you know.
That's kind of what that... it was actually a bit interesting that the remake tanked as badly as it did. Because, to my mind... remakes are generally unnecessary, and frequently when they fail, it's deserved, because a lot of people make remakes unintelligently, you know, that there's nothing, that they don't say anything that hasn't already been said. And when a remake,
unless it's Ron Moore in Battlestar Galactica and it's a reimagining.
Well, I was going to bring that up, actually, because the thing is, that worked because they weren't sort of trying to, quote-unquote, remake it, you know, what it... Reimagining's a bit pretentious, I still think, but, you know, they weren't trying to remake it in the sense of, let's just go for all the same beats. You know, they were basically saying, okay, what has this series got still to say? You know, what hasn't been said in this series? And in fact...
and also, you know...
as we argue in the book...
The original series was said was you know, a product of 1978 and was about sort of neoconservatism.
I'm getting there. Can I finish my sentence, please?
Yes, Alan. Professor Fiona Moore finish her sentence.
What it still had to say was that the original series was done at a time when neoconservatism was just beginning. And in the intervening 35 years, neoconservatism was effectively had effectively run its course. So the new series could pick up and basically... take the optimism of the original series and kind of turn it into a case of, you know, kind of our philosophy has failed, what next?
You also got a situation where the first series only ran for 17 episodes because it was cancelled. So it wasn't a case of where, you know, there was a beginning and middle and end. It was kind of a beginning and middle and then no end.
But the thing was that the failure of the Prisoner remake surprised me because it seemed to me that it did in a way, you know, rather than sort of saying, let's just remake the Prisoner, you know, let's put this guy in the village and have number two or whatever. They said, okay, what was McGowan trying to do in the 60s and what are people doing along the same lines now? So they wound up doing something that was a lot less What's New Pussycat and a lot more Inception.
Exactly.
You know, and as I said, you know, watching that, I really respected that. I thought, you know, they're not trying to do a straight remake. They're sort of saying, what is today's version of the kind of head trip that McGowan was on in the 60s and went for that?
I think you're right. I think that was a successful part of it. I think the reason why it was less successful, why it failed, or was forgotten, is because the lead man didn't have a third of the charisma of Patrick McGowan.
There is that.
You know, Patrick McGowan...
It was Jim Caviezel.
Sorry?
It was Jesus, Jim Caviezel. What more charisma could you want? He was, you know...
He wasn't Patrick McGowan, was he?
That's true. We could go on and on with respect to The Crow and all sorts of other bits and pieces, but, Claire, you need to ask Alan and Fiona those last two questions. Go.
Have you enjoyed your telephonic link with us today?
Oh, yes.
Good. Mm-hmm. And will we be talking to you again soon?
Assuming you don't die in betwixt times.
Yes.
I'm sure you do, and if we do die, we'll come back.
Good. Bring it back.
Yes. Alan Stevens and Fiona Moore, CaldorCity.com, will be back with us. Mary, have you enjoyed your show?
I have. It's been great.
Back again soon?
Yep.
Excellent. And Claire, back on Wednesday.
Indeed.
Splendid. That's it. Daft Punk featuring Pharrell Williams takes us out. We say thanks to Kat, Michael Blackburn, Mary Dancy, Claire Margerison, Richard Fitzwilliams, Ian Lennox, Max Cockett, William Sitwell, Alan Stevens, and Fiona Moore. And you, dear listener, keep on keeping on. Can we all say bye-bye? One, two, three.
Bye. Bye.